Good afternoon. So last time we finished up talking about two-phase commit, which is what our current assignment is about. We mentioned the issue that, well, you have to deal with delayed messages. And one thing you have to worry about is what if some message from something you've already done comes along. You need to know, well, I already did that. You need to keep track of that. And that's something that's just that networks can do. And we went through our assignment and the whole bunch of simplifications to make it like the simplest example of two-phase commit I could come up with that I could still kind of call two-phase commits. Then we talked about extensions to two-phase commit. So things which went from a complicated two-phase commit to really complicated because we had a more ambitious goal. With two-phase commit, we were just saying, we're going to keep everyone consistent and we're going to work normally when everyone's working, but when someone goes away, we're going to pause for a while and when they come back, we'll get things back to normal. That's what two-phase commit was all about, was just getting things back to normal afterwards. And for that reason, we required unanimity to actually do anything in two-phase commit. But often we want to continue operating when we're missing machines. The most common case for this is that we'll have like 3 or 5 copies of everything. Say 3 data centers in different parts of the country, and if any one of them goes away, we want things to continue to work. And to make this provide consistency, a key thing that we could do was always contact overlapping sets of machines, so at least one of the people we were contacting would know about every prior thing that happened. So then we moved on to our main topic for today. We introduced very briefly this idea of protection, these mechanisms for controlling what programs can do, and compared it to the idea of security. You know, the more general idea that we have some actual goals about what we want to accomplish, some policy, and protection is the mechanism by which we're going to make that happen, hopefully. And we talked about, you know, wanting to keep people from accessing things, we needed to know who can do what. And we divided this problem up into 2 pieces. So one part was authentication, which is who is running, you know. And the other part is, given that I know who is running, what are they allowed to do, which we'll call authorization. And I mentioned that we're mostly going to not solve the authentication problem. We're just going to delegate that to someone else. And we're going to talk about how operating systems can delegate that task and deal primarily with the authorization task, which they need to deal with because they're the ones who control the resources that we want to limit what can be done with them. So before I move on to talk more about access control today, any questions about things from last time? Okay. So we picked off last time. We were talking about this authorization versus authentication. So we're going to talk about how we do authorization. Skip over. So one way of representing who can do what is that we can just have a big table. And in our table, we're going to have every possible thing that you might want to do something with. And we're going to have a bunch of what we'll call protection domains. We'll talk more concretely about what those protection domains are in a bit. But we're going to assign each process to a bunch of these protection domains. And each of those protection domains will give it the ability to do certain things based on that. And those abilities will apply to a bunch of objects, which, you know, can be files, like processes. And there's these operations we don't want everyone to be able to do. So for files, it's pretty obvious. We have reading and writing. If you've used a shared machine like our department machines, you may have noticed like there's some files you can't read or write, or using our VM, you might have noticed you accidentally made it so you can't read or write something. We have some other things like execute. For processes, we're going to have similar things, and this applies to all sorts of things the OS lets us manipulate. For processes, sometimes you can kill a process. We don't want you to be able to kill every process on a shared machine. So we're going to limit that somehow. And our preview is that our protection domains are going to represent what we call users or groups, and I'll talk about what that means from the OS perspective more concretely. And this is the choice that's made in POSIX. Most commonly in real operating systems, we have this notion of a user, which is supposed to represent a human, but there's no actual requirement that that's the case. It's just sort of a name for the OS. So we have these users and these groups. So we'll first talk about users. These are the most important kind of protection domains. And they're supposed to represent like a human typically, but for the OS perspective, they're just going to be a number. We're going to assign an ID to every user, and the operating system is going to track that ID for every process. So each process is going to have a user ID, and that user ID is going to be used inside the OS, inside all its system call implementations, to decide what that process is authorized to do. And there's going to have to be some procedure, which we'll talk about later, for actually setting the user ID. And in POSIX, we learned about fork. So fork is going to copy the process we learned. One of the things that's going to be copied is this user ID. Yes? The question is, the user ID the same thing as the process ID? No. So a user ID is another identifier in a process, and there can be many processes with the same user. And this will typically be the case. So if I log into a machine, every program I run is probably going to have the same user ID, which corresponds to represent me somehow. So POSIX has user IDs, and there's a way of getting them. So there's a system call called getEUID, which gets the effective user ID. So you might say, why are we qualifying this with effective? We'll get to that later. But this is the one which matters. And this is the number the kernel knows about. And this is what the kernel is going to check whenever you need to do something like open a file. It's going to look at this effective user ID for the program which called open and say, what does that mean the program is allowed to do? And as you can see from the effective name, yeah, there's going to be some other user IDs. You might wonder, well, if they're not used, checked on open, what are we using them for? We'll get to that later. Okay. So you might say, if we have these IDs, and this ID is whatever this UIDT is, and this is, you know, typically this is going to be, this is, you know, probably an int or something similar. So that's not what you see if you like type ls minus l. You might have seen a username, or if you're logging into a machine, you type a username. So where do the usernames come from? So in a typical POSIX system, there are programs and libraries that maintain the mapping between name and number. This is not something that the kernel needs to deal with at all. We can just delegate that to programs that run and that like display usernames, that take usernames from input to let you log in. Those are just all going to be programs that are going to look up in this mapping that's maintained just outside of the kernel entirely. And the kernel, you know, and the system call implementations only need to know about these IDs. The names is just, you know, something added on top of that. And POSIX systems typically place this mapping in a special file called etc/password. This traditionally, it's not the only place you might find it. This is on a single user machine, and if we have a network machine, we're actually going to use some sort of network database to maintain it, because probably you don't want to update every single machine in the department when you add a user. You just want to update one place. And these libraries will know how to contact that network database to look up a username. So in addition to users, we're also going to have groups. And the idea of groups is that we have users with similar privileges. For example, maybe you want to have some files that all faculty can access. So you want to create a group for that to represent that. So we're going to have groups with names like faculty. And like with our users, we're going to represent these names with an ID as far as the kernel is concerned. So the kernel is going to track groups for a process. Now, unlike users, we're not going to assume that there's only one user, only one person representing a process. You know, we assume that process, one person. We don't assume one group, that I can be, you know, faculty and computer science. Those are two sensible groups to have. So you want to support having a list of groups. So POSIX supports an effective group ID and some extra group IDs. You might say, why isn't it just a list of group IDs? Just historical, it's not no good reason. But there's a list of group IDs that are used. So when we open a file, we're not only going to check this user ID, we're also going to check all those group IDs that are assigned to a process. And if you log into a typical POSIX system, there's often a command called ID, which just makes these system calls and prints all this stuff out. So I type ID sometime last semester on a department machine, and I get, here's my user ID that my shell was running with, and therefore the ID program ran with. And here's my primary group ID, the one returned by this get EGID system call. And also all the other groups. And this command is showing names for them, but the kernel just knows the numbers. This looked up the names in that database using libraries that were just all in user space. They just knew there was a network server to contact where you could give it a group ID and it would tell you, here's the name for that. Yes?
Are we going to have a hierarchy?
So the question is, can we have a hierarchy of groups? So the mechanism we've talked about, we're just going to inherit the groups when we call fork. So there's nothing that's going to support that, but you're allowed to set those group IDs however you want so far. So there's nothing limiting you from setting them in a way which enforces that property. But you're not going to get any help with the mechanism we've seen so far for that. Other questions? That's for having nested groups, sort of groups that automatically contain other groups. Yeah, right here we just have IDs. There's no other information the kernel knows about. But if you're setting them, you can take advantage of whatever you want to know. Now, the groups you've seen here, these seem to correspond to sort of things that are about the user. That's sort of the most common thing. But we don't actually have to use groups this way. And often you'll actually see groups that don't actually meet this pattern. So one example is some systems will have a video group that controls access to the monitor. And when you log in directly to a machine, we'll put you in the video group so you can use the monitor. If you're SSHing into the machine, we're not gonna put your processes in the video group. And this will be something that's set when we start your first process. We'll decide based on how you're logged in, what to set. So we don't have to use these as something that just is like information we could have gotten from the user ID anyways. These can be actual extra information about how our process is running, and therefore what we want to allow it to do. This is sort of just supported by this group ID mechanism. Now, this seems pretty useful until you think very carefully about, well, if I'm writing a program as the video group, when does my program exit? And there's nothing really stopping me from keeping it running in the background most of the time. So this actually usually doesn't do much unless you like somehow make sure you kill all those programs that are still running with that extra group. Okay. So we talked about our protection domains here, and the way that POSIX has chosen to represent them. That's not the only way you could do it. It's just what POSIX has chosen for what these possible protection domains are. And now we have to figure out how do we represent the actual what you can do for each thing. And there's two sort of options which you'll commonly see for representing this. And we're going to talk about the most common, which is this idea of an access control list. That along with each of those objects, we're going to store who is allowed to access it and what they're allowed to do. In some format, there's a bunch of formats we're going to talk about, well, two of them. Another option would be that we could just have like the list on the side. We could have a list of this user, this file can read it, like somewhere in some configuration file. This is a thing which is really done occasionally. But the idea of storing it with the file or with the process usually seems to be most intuitive, so it's usually what we're going to do. And there are two versions of this storing it for files that POSIX specifies, and I'll go through both. I'll start with the one which is always supported, which are POSIX file permissions, which have a really restricted way of specifying this. And that mechanism is that files can have one user ID, and for that user ID, you can specify can that user read, write, or execute. And that user ID also has the permissions to change these permissions. And you can't turn that off. They just have it. There's one group ID. If you wanted multiple groups, that's too bad. And you can specify, can that group ID read, write, or execute? And then there's a default. If someone accesses it and they aren't the user and aren't in the group, what can they do? Read, write, or execute. You can just turn on and off read, or write, or execute for each of these classes. So this has the advantage of being nice and compact to store, but it's not actually very flexible. Like if you look at this table here, like it looks like we can specify all sorts of interesting policies. You know, I can like choose two users, two different protection domains, and make them be able to read the file. And that's not actually something we can do with this mechanism, just because we just don't have a way of writing it down. So POSIX later on added some more flexible access control lists, which are called POSIX access control lists. And this is also something which other OSs have had for a while. So for example, NTFS has access control lists, which look kind of like this. And these are just going to be a more freeform list of here's a bunch of users and groups and what they can do. And when doing the open call, we're just going to scan through this list to figure out what happens. So NTFS, Windows has supported this for a while, and POSIX has standardized a version of it, and sometimes it's even supported. Sometimes it's not. It happens that the depart machines now actually support it on most of the file systems, but that wasn't always the case. That's not always supported. But this is like the flexible mechanism. This is what you probably wanted it to be there. And in POSIX access control list, you specify this access control list with a little configuration file. I'll show you an example here. So we can just specify a list of groups and users. And for each of those, we can specify what they can do. So rather than being limited to saying, this group can do this, this group can do this, we can specify something like, students can read and execute this, faculty can read, write, and execute this. Now specify that rule. And we can specify exceptions for individual users. So we can specify MST3K, maybe some student, can rewrite or execute even though they're not faculty. And we can specify some special user gets no permissions. So we have this list. And there has to be some rule about, well, what if a process is running as user MST3K in the students group? What happens? What if a process is running as TJ1A user in the faculty group? What happens? Or what if a process is running as students and faculty? So we need some rules to figure out what happens there. And POSIX has made a bunch of rules for that. And their rules are basically that users entries take precedence over group entries, and you get sort of the maximum permissions of the first category you get to. So we can see that this lets us do a lot of different policies, and it's actually fairly easy for the OS to implement. Probably the trickiest thing is we need to store this somewhere. So this needs to be stored in our file system somewhere. So now we need to add a way for our file system to represent alongside our inode this access control list and somehow look that up. And then we just need to read that on open and make sure, yep, you can actually open this file. Okay. So that's our sort of way of specifying it. And to actually check this is something we're going to do when we have relevant system calls. So for files, we're going to check on open. We also check on things like rename and other operations that don't take a file descriptor. We'll check file and directory permissions. And if they don't match, we're just going to return an error. We're not going to do anything. We also have other things we need to check permissions for, where we don't actually have a direct access control list. So one example is processes. If I kill a process, when am I allowed to do that? And you might like it to be the case that I could set an access control list for my process. But unfortunately, POSIX did not have the foresight to support that. So the way it works is that they said the UID of the process has to equal the UID that's killing it for it to work. And they make other rules sort of ad hoc for the other cases. And you might say that doesn't, having different rules for processes and, for, anything else we're going to have shared access to seems like that's kind of annoying. It is. It's maybe a bad design choice and kind of something which happened from POSIX sort of adding on support for this access control kind of late. If you were designing an OS from scratch, this might be something you want to think about really early. How do I make it so I can specify who can access a process to kill it the same way I can specify who can read a file? Okay, so questions? Yes, yeah?
Kind of unrelated, but if you're on your computer and you decide to run some program as admin, are you changing your permissions, or was that more of a group?
So the question is, what does it mean to run as admin or sudo or whatever? So there's a special user in POSIX, which is user ID 0, which is sometimes called super user or root. And this is special because some system calls have a hardwired access control list of these work for UID 0 and no one else. For example, the system call to shut down the system usually works that way. Or the system call to mount file system usually works that way. Only works for user ID 0. Everyone else, we're just going to say, nope, can't do that. And for other system calls, we're just going to bypass permission checks. So on an open, we're just going to say, yep, you can open it. Ignore the access control list. And this is what you commonly might see referred to as administrator or so on. So I'm mentioning this in POSIX, so Windows works differently, but there's an equivalent user ID in Windows that does something similar, which is actually not administrator, but system, I believe, but I don't actually know all the details. Yeah?
So do you need a control list for who's allowed to be a super user?
So the question is, how does this happen? We'll get to that later. How do you become this if you don't have it? Yeah, we'll get to that later. That's a very good question, though, because obviously I shouldn't just let any program become super user. That would kind of defeat the point of having these access control lists. So getting to the question of how do we become some user, let's talk about the most obvious way we become some user, which is logging in. So I have some program that I'm entering input into, where I type in my user ID and a password, and then I'm logged in as that user ID. So this is just a normal program. This is generally not actually part of the kernel. It's just a process that's running, and it takes in a username and a password. It checks if the password is correct, and somehow changes user IDs and runs a shell. So one thing which is happening here is we have to check if the password is correct. And because we're just having a program do this, the kernel doesn't actually know how the passwords are stored. But because, you know, it's probably something we should talk about, say, well, how is it going to do that? Well, we're just going to have either a special file or a network service. So if we have a special file, we'll have a file which is only readable by root or superuser. And our trick is we're going to run this login program that I just typed my user and password into as root or superuser so it can read that file, but ordinary users cannot. Another option is we'll have some sort of network service, and the network service will have some way of verifying that it's this special root or superuser that's talking to it. One example would be that we could have a secret value stored that only root can read that it would send to the network service. But it's just making a decision entirely in user space, and we're just relying on this idea that we can protect files from regular users or protect other information from regular users being able to access it to enforce that you can't learn everyone's passwords. And because this is just in user space, we don't actually have to use passwords. This program could use whatever criteria it wants. And we wouldn't have to change the kernel. We just change this program, make it decide on something other than a password. Okay, so then we have to change user IDs. So how does that work? Well, the user ID is going to be part of the information the kernel tracks about the process. It's going to be in the process control block. So we're going to have a system call to do it. And in POSIX, there's a system call called setUID. And if you're super user, it changes the effective user ID to whatever value you put in. Kernel doesn't check that that value makes sense. It just sets it if you're super user. So the login program just starts as super user, takes in your username and password, and then sets the user ID, runs your shell. Okay. Some questions? How we do our login? Okay. So that answers logging in. Now, many of you, probably including on our VM for this course, have run a command with sudo. And sudo is this program you run as your, from your shell running with your user ID, not super user. And it runs a command as super user. It asks you for your password first, but it runs a command as super user. And well, we just talked about how to change user IDs, but we have this constraint. If already super user, you can set a user ID. And we can say call set UID 0, but hopefully we can't just have any program become super user. Yeah. That's the reason we had this sudo ask for a password. You know, hopefully there's a reason it had to do that, and it's not like pointless. So sudo is an ordinary program we run, but it ends up running as superuser. So there's a special mechanism for that. And in POSIX, we've elected to have an extra metadata bit on the executables, which is going to be stored in the file system, called the setUserID bit. And when this is set, the exec system call behaves differently. It will change the effective user ID to the owner of the file, the executable file. So the sudo program is owned by root and marked with this extra bit. So when you run it, it runs as root. And that's why it can run commands as root. And because it doesn't want to let you just do anything as root, it asks you for a password first. That's just a decision it made. It's, when it starts running, it can do whatever it wants. Well, that anything that super user can do. And this is something you could set on any program. There's a chmod command to set this. It's one of the permission bits. That's not really a permission bit, but it's stored in the same field of a file. Just like the can I read or write it information. So, question on this idea? So, set user ID, in some sense, this is this very elegant abstraction that it's sort of a gate to a higher privilege, that we can use set user ID programs to make interesting decisions outside the kernel. And sudo is a good example of this, that we wanted to decide that you're going to be able to do certain things as root, but not everything. And sudo is very configurable. We can specify, we want you to be able to run it if you type in your password, or you want you to be able to only run certain commands. And sudo can apply that policy for us without us having to add code to the kernel to like decide what users are allowed to do this, what commands are they allowed to run. And it's actually very commonly used for more specific programs where there's like one thing we want a user to do that requires more privileges than we want. So what we'll do is we'll write a program just for that thing, make it owned by root or some other user that can do it, and mark it set user ID, and allow the user to do one thing. And on a typical Unix-like desktop, there are a lot of these programs lying around for common tasks where typically we haven't modified the kernel to actually have sufficiently nuanced access control lists to decide all the things we want users to be able to do or not do. So one example is mounting a USB stick. I plug in a USB stick. Sometimes we want regular users to mount it, but we don't actually want them to be able to mount it in every possible way. So for example, we don't want you to mount it on top of like important system files. And typically, the real mount system call that actually implements this could do that. And rather than have the kernel implement some check for that, typically, this decision is we have some program which decides where it gets mounted and makes sure that's OK. Another thing we don't want you to do is we don't want you to be able to mount a normal hard drive that you're not supposed to mount and mess up the file system inadvertently. We can enforce that it's only the USB sticks you can mount, even though, without hard coding in the kernel, these are the USB sticks. This is what they are. We talked about the set user ID idea, and it would be really bad if you could mount a new set user ID program. That's probably a security problem. So we can control how mount is used to prevent anything on that USB stick from being interpreted as set user ID. So another common example is we have something like a printer or a monitor that we want programs to be able to access, but we don't want to give programs raw access to the port that the printer or monitor is hooked up to. So we can have a program like that knows how to talk to the printer, knows how to do it in a way which like doesn't print too much and doesn't like mess with other things that are connected to like the same USB port, and control access to the device that way. You might imagine writing to a secure log file. Let's say you want to append something to a log, but we don't want to let anyone just erase the log. When we talked about our file permissions, we had a way of specifying you could write to a file, but we didn't have a way of specifying you can only append to a file. But if we want to implement that, we can write a program that appends to a file, mark it set user ID, and you can use that program, but only to append to the file. You can't overwrite the file. Another example we saw was binding to port numbers. So when I talked about port numbers and servers, I mentioned that POSIX has just by convention said 0 to 1023 are reserved for super user, root. What if we want to let a program use one of those? Well, we can have a set user ID program which binds to one of those ports and then switches back to the original user with that file descriptor open. Yes?
How do you switch back to the normal user?
So if we're running as root with the set UID system call that we talked about for login, same way. Other questions? So we can consider this set user ID mechanism as sort of an analogy to sort of user-space system calls. That system calls, the hardware decided some things only the kernel can do, and system calls are a way to give you controlled access to those things only the kernel can do. In the same way, we can think of set user ID programs being the kernel decided some things only root or some other user can do, and the set user ID programs are a way to give controlled access to those things root can do in ways, you know, that the kernel hasn't done. Okay. Now, from what I've talked about, set user ID programs might seem like a good mechanism, but actually I think a lot of people in the security community would say they're probably a big mistake. So let's talk about this with a concrete example. A case which looks like a good use for set UID programs, and one I've seen in practice, though not implemented poorly. So suppose I have a directory all grades on a shared server with the grades for a class. Obviously, I don't let everyone read that directory. And I have a text file for each assignment, for each user's grade, and you know other info. And I don't have a way of like setting it up quickly so I can like give user access to each of their files. So instead of doing that, I want to just write a set user ID program where you know you run print grade assignment and it outputs this file with your username. So filled in for user. No, just a way to let you access grades. Okay. So here's an attempt at doing that. And there is an incredibly huge amount of stuff which can go wrong with this program. And I'll just give you a minute or two to look at it, and we can start talking about what could possibly go wrong here. Anyone with one example of something which could go wrong can be a problem. Yeah? Not closing the file descriptor. So that's not a problem because the program exits right afterwards. So it's closed automatically. Yeah?
Pass it the argument dot dot slash dot dot slash dot slash.
Yeah, so one issue is that in here, where we put our argument, this could be dot dot slash dot dot slash dot dot slash and so on, and we could read files outside the all grades directory that we're not supposed to read. Now, this maybe doesn't seem so bad because the file has to be named based on our user, it looks like, but you have something to say? Yeah. So you can set the user environment variable. So we very, very briefly talked about environment variables, which is what we're using here. So this is an environment variable. And this is passed along with exec. And this is not set by, not set securely. This is set, can be set to anything. Set by user to anything. Now, the reason I'm using this user environment variable is there's a convention that the login program sets this user environment variable, my shell sets this user environment variable to my actual username. But the set user ID program doesn't need to be run with it set correctly. I can set it incorrectly to any file name I want, and it seems like I can read extra files by doing that, because it's just some part of my program's data that's passed to the next program. It's not actually controlled. It's not actually doing the lookup. So what we wanted to do instead was get the current, get the user ID we originally had, and there's a way of doing that, and then use that to look up the name in the database that the library manages that we know will have the correct map. Now, you might say, well, at least the file is going to be a text file. You're not going to read some other file. Anyone have? Okay, someone else? So you're saying we could have a null pointer? So that would be a concern if we weren't using sprintf to make this string. But sprintf expects a null terminated string with %s. So happily, that's not something we can do. But there is still a problem. And there's some other mechanism we talked about earlier in the semester with file systems, which makes this particularly problem, which makes the dot text thing like not actually matter. So the mechanism we were talking about was, so you remember link and symlink? Link let us make a new name for a file, and symlink let us make an alias for a file based on the name. So we can make a .txt file that points to some other file that's more important. So what we've learned here is that despite our intentions, despite what this code looks like, we can in fact read any file, cause any file to be read as whoever this user program runs as. So are there any other problems here? Someone else, yeah.
When you open the file, you give it write permissions?
Yeah, so we're opening with write permissions. So that seems like something we shouldn't do. Can we get in trouble, though, for that? So there is a way that can cause a problem. But the question is how, because we never call, it doesn't look like we call write, does it? So is there anything which calls write here? Print, you said? Print calls write. So what is this print write to? What does it write to? People have answers. So. So it writes to a buffer first, but where does that eventually get written to? Standard out. To standard out. And how do we know what standard out is? What is standard out in POSIX? It came up in the shell assignment. File descriptor 1. Okay. So something that maybe we didn't talk about when we talked about open, open always assigns the lowest available file descriptor. So if you run this program with file descriptor 1 closed, that open call will create file descriptor 1. And then that print call will write to file descriptor 1. So that's how we can end up writing to the file. Which we really didn't, so like when you read this program, like you probably said, okay, you can probably read the wrong file or something. But no, in fact you can write to an arbitrary file. Yeah, so any other things which are wrong? Yeah. Yeah, so yeah, this is also a fixed size buffer, and we don't actually check, you know, the length. So there's a buffer overflow. Sometimes our compiler will save us there. On modern systems, though, it will recognize as a fixed size buffer and turn it into a special sprintf call. Anything else? So you're saying you can overwrite a file? Yeah, so you can overwrite the file which is being pointed to. So, and I guess something, yeah, so one other thing to think of is that we overwrite it 1,024 bytes in. So I imagine if you're really clever, you can figure out how to overwrite an executable 1,024 bytes in and have that make it so when you run that executable later on or someone else runs that executable later on, it does something useful for to you. So this probably ends up turning into a run whatever code you want as this user because we had a slightly buggy set user ID program. And like, it's a really subtle bugs. And like one of them, like, you know, the first thing someone noticed, like, looked like it wouldn't matter if you read the code, the read-write flag. So writing set user ID programs is incredibly difficult to do safely. Like, this was an example that I contrived to deliberately have lots of flaws, but it's incredibly difficult to, like, cuss all your things, especially because we have, like, these really weird ways your programs can be run, like with standard out closed, with the path environment variable set to point to Mrs. Program. So if you like run a shell in your set UID program, LS is in fact a malicious program. You know, what if argc is 0? How does your program behave? Because we can exec your program that way. And so on. So this is like a big problem with set user ID programs and why I don't actually recommend writing one. There's other problems that come up when writing this sort of program, even ignoring the issues about how is my environment set up. Now let's go through an example of a very common class of problems like this, starting with a hypothetical set user ID program where we're going to have a printing program, mark set UID to access a printer. And it takes a file to print from its command line. So can we just open that file? So the answer, as you're guessing from me asking, the answer is no. So what, but why not? What's wrong with just opening that file? Why would that probably not give us, you know, the security properties we expect if we just call open on the file that's passed in as an argument from our print program? Yeah, so it could be a file that's like etc shadow, like that contains passwords, or something that we're not supposed to be able to read. And if the print program just calls open on it, and it's running as root, then we could use this to read any file by printing it out. So we don't want to allow that. So you might say, okay, so what we're going to do instead is we're going to say, can you read the file? If so, we're going to open it and print. But this doesn't work. And the problem is that there's a race condition. And the race condition looks something like this. I create my file to print. I call my setuid program. And at the same time, while it's running, just, you know, I sneak in, try to sneak in just after it makes that check, replacing my normal file with a link or a symbolic link to some secret file. And this is known as a time to check to time of use vulnerability. And we want to let people who are writing these set user ID programs avoid this problem. So we're going to have a special mechanism for that. And our mechanism is that we're going to let them temporarily switch their user ID back to the original user, then do the open, and switch back to the special user. So when they do the open, we check the access control list as usual with the correct user, and we don't have any window between when we check and when we do the open for something to go wrong. That we're doing it, we're doing the checks with the right user ID when we do the open, not at some other time. And this is why I mentioned that we have multiple user IDs to support this. Okay, so questions? This idea. So I'm going to go into what are these multiple user IDs look like very briefly. But first, just a note on this. So you might say, okay, this seems like a problem, but it seems really hard to get the timing right. You're going to be printing out a lot of junk before you get this right. But like we have the problem with setting up the environment weird for a setuid program, like the attacker has a lot of control in this other program to make this work out better. And a solution which was found to make this usually work out is something known as sort of symlink mazes, that we just have a whole bunch of symbolic links that the open call is going to resolve to make the open call really slow, to give us more time to replace the final file at the end of those whole bunch of symbolic links. And we can do these sorts of tricks of just like doing something that makes things slow or slows things down to turn what seems like these really improbable time to check to time of use vulnerabilities into things that we can like consistently make happen pretty quickly, which is why they're a huge concern. So, mentioned that we have multiple user IDs. So POSIX, in fact, has 3 user IDs for every process. You might say, that seems like more than we need, and it is. And the history is that there were 2 different schemes for letting us temporarily swap to a user for that open and swap back. And POSIX needed to decide, which one are we going to put in the standard? And the answer was, both. So they're just 2 independent schemes which both do the same thing, and they're both in the standard. So one of them is this notion of a real user ID, which is what the getUID system call returns. And another one is something called the save set user ID. But the key thing is whatever of these 2 extra user IDs we're using, the program can swap these all the time. And when a set user ID program starts, its effective user ID would be, for example, would be the owner of that file, so usually root. And the real user ID will be the program that actually started the program. You can see where the names come from. The real user ID is who's running sudo. The effective user ID is root. So we can temporarily swap our real and effective user IDs to run the open, then swap back, And that swapping is safe because we remember that we're allowed to become root again with the real user ID being swapped to root. Okay. And that's how we're going to support this operation. And both this real and saved user ID are just ways of remembering for set user ID programs. The other user ID is how they're initially set, the one that ran the program that wasn't changed to. And as I said, these were sort of one thing which were combined, combined together in POSIX because there were two different solutions. POSIX just said, we'll do both of them. Sounds great. So one note, if you ever are in the position of writing code that deals with these user IDs, there is a proliferation of set functions, and they don't do what you think they do. So for example, set UID changes all the UIDs. You might think, well, the get real UID call is get UID, so set UID must set that. No, it sets all of them. Or just sets the effective one. SetUID changes only the effective one, and setRUID changes the real and effective, and sometimes also changes the saved one, even though that's not mentioned there. So this is really confusing. There's a nice paper on this called SetUID Demystified from a while back, but it's really confusing, so if you ever deal with it, be careful. This has caused real bugs and real security bugs in set user ID programs, getting this wrong. Okay. So I mentioned this for user IDs. So all the functionality I talked about for user IDs exists for group IDs in POSIX. So there's set group ID programs, and there's calls to swap group IDs and additional group IDs to do the same type of tricks we want to do of letting someone do something that only a particular group can do that we do for users. Okay, some questions on our set user ID idea? Okay, so now that we know about POSIX permissions, let's go through a few tasks here. So let's say I want to have students collaborate in ad hoc groups on a shared server. So how should I use POSIX mechanisms to do this? Or alternately, what should I allow and not allow? What's the things we want to do to make this, to achieve the security properties we actually want? Here, what's a reasonable policy in this case? No one. Yeah. Okay. Edit. Access. Same file, somehow, okay. So that's what we want, same files. Okay, so what's our mechanism for this? What mechanisms does POSIX provide? What's a mechanism POSIX provides that's gonna let us do this? So we could create a group, add the users to the group, on login, or add processes of the users to the group on login, and change shared files to that group, and allow them to be read or written by that group. Okay. That's the easy one. So how about students should have the word submit. So how about if we want to let students submit assignment files? So what security properties do we want here? Okay. Have a submitting files. We have a server that students can access and faculty can access. We want to submit files to faculty. What should be true about those files you submit? Yeah. Okay. Can only submit for self. Anything else? Yeah. Only read own submissions. Yeah. Faculty can only read their submissions. Okay, so how can we implement this? So what's a mechanism which supports this type of policy? POSIX provides. So we have user IDs, yes. So how are we going to use them, though?
For example, for can only submit for themselves, we could check
these.
The user who's submitting.
Okay. So user IDs of owner to ID submitter. Okay. So we can check that way. Okay. Yeah.
So we can make it so that files when submitted to a certain faculty member corresponds to a certain group ID.
Okay. That's a question we need to answer. So who should be able to write submitted files?
I would say the faculty should not be able to write.
Okay. So should the student be able to write?
Well, once they submit it, like once it's part of that system, then they're assuming there's no resubmission.
Yeah. So group ID for faculty, and your notion is make file accessible by group. Group with ACL. But we have this problem that we want to prevent the user from being able to write it afterwards. Sort of. So one question is prevent user from writing. Now you might say, well, you can remove write permission with an access control list, so on. But if the user created the file, or if they're the owner, they have permissions to change those permissions. And this also applies to POSIX access control lists. So that's a problem. So the only mechanism I know of which can achieve this is set user ID programs, but that's kind of, you know, right. So this is set UID programs to change the owner. Like that seems like what we have to do. Maybe you can think of a clever way. Yes.
Would you be able to create like a service account specifically for task, and then just change that service account and what that service account?
Yeah. So your notion is set UID program, but it's going to be set UID to special service user. Special service user. So there's a submission user that actually copies the files to itself so the user can no longer write to them. So that would be a viable mechanism. Okay. So pointing out here that not always great fit for some security like this seems like sort of nice security properties. This seems relatively simple. It's just about reading and writing. But because we have this notion of editing the permissions, like it doesn't actually work out that we can do everything we want to do. And another example, I won't go through the details, but let's say I want to run an untrusted game from the internet. Does POSIX provide me a good way of doing this? Like the best we can do is create a new user for it and hope that user can't access anything important. So one last security topic is that we've so far talked about this notion of having these user and group IDs that are part of the process, and they determine what you can access, and the access information is stored alongside the file. This is sometimes known as ambient authority, that just around your process and your files is the information and the ability to authorize them, to access them or not. So there's an alternate approach, which some operating systems use and has some advantages, where rather than having this information on the side, we couple it tightly with how you address the files or other resources. And this is known as capabilities. And our idea is that you're going to have a token to access something, and that token is your permission to access it. You either have the token and you can access it, or you don't have a token to access the resource and you can't. And the advantage here is that our what does this token refer to check is our can you access this check. They're the same thing. So this is arguably simpler. Minimally, it's very hard to forget to do this check. And in POSIX, we've actually seen some things which behave like these capabilities, even though POSIX really isn't designed around capabilities. So one example is file descriptors. So your file descriptor is this token you use to access a file. And we know you can access the file because you have it open. You have a file descriptor for it. And there's no possible way of getting confused and having you specify a valid file descriptor you're not allowed to access. Like either you have the file descriptor and you can use it, or you can't. You can kind of think of a page table being the same thing, that it's the list of physical pages you're allowed to access. Either you have a virtual address for that page and you can access it, or you don't. You can't just make up a physical page number and go to it. You have to use a virtual address. If you don't have one, you can't access it. And a common thing you see here is that these capabilities are lists of what the process can access that are stored with the process. So rather than storing a user ID and a group ID, we're storing a list of what you can access with the process. Your handle is just a key in the list of what you can access. And you know, there's an unskippable permission check of just seeing, is it in the list? So capabilities solves the permission check, but it seems a lot less flexible. And one way it seems less flexible is how do you share these things between programs? Well, we have one mechanism, but that seems kind of insufficient, which is that it's inherited by spawn programs. That if I fork, I still have the same file descriptors, so that's a way of sharing file descriptors. Often we'll have other mechanisms, and in fact, most Unix systems allow you to send file descriptors over a local socket or pipe, over a local socket. The details vary, but there's usually a way of copying a file descriptor from one process to another over a local socket. Okay. But give an idea of what this mechanism looked like, I'm going to talk about a concrete implementation of capabilities on top of Unix. So these people said, well, Unix went part of the way with these file descriptors. We want to go the rest of the way and have everything use capabilities. We don't want to use these access control lists at all. So they added this to FreeBSD. And because they were adding it to FreeBSD and they still needed to support existing programs that use things like file names, which have, you know, you need permission, like with the root directory, they had it be opt-in, that a process could opt-in to being capability only, just to support legacy code. And their capabilities were file descriptors. But rather than just have file descriptors for regular files, they also extended file descriptors so they could have them for directories, for processes, for every other thing you might want to access. They just created new types of file descriptors. And so that was the idea was that was your token to access any sort of thing the OS manages is a file descriptor now. And because there were more operations you need to do, they added extra permission bits to the file descriptor. So our normal file descriptors keep track of can you read or write the file. So they added execute or open files in a directory if the file descriptor represents a directory, or kill if the file descriptor represents a process. They just added these extra permission flags in addition to read and write. Okay, so this is how we're tracking our objects. But then there's some things that it seems like we're going to have trouble doing. So one question is, well, if I have to use capabilities to access anything, how do I access files in a directory? So their answer was you'd have relative paths, but no absolute paths. So you wouldn't have paths starting with slash. They'd always be starting at a directory. And there would be an open at system call, which took a file descriptor representing a directory and a path. And the idea is, like you would be passed standard out, you'd be passed your current directory, your main directory, as a file descriptor. And you just know to use that in OpenAt. And we could think of this as, like, if I'm running as a particular user, you get your home directory as a file descriptor, that's all you can access now. And for running an executable, we have to pass a file name to execv. Instead, we have a version of execv which takes a file descriptor. So another problem we had was fork. So fork, we had process IDs, and process IDs were, they look like file descriptors, but they're global. Like, if you have process ID 15, it's 15 on the entire system. It's not a token that tells you you can access, do something to process 15. So they have a new system call they call PD fork, process descriptor fork, which instead of returning a process ID, returns a file descriptor you can use to kill or wait for that process. So questions? This idea? So this was sort of a concrete implementation. You can see when we're done, the only way we can access things is through these capabilities. We don't have any global names. So we had previously, we had these global file names, which were the same everywhere. Now, the only way we access files is using this file descriptor to tell us where to start. And previously, we had PIDs, which were the same everywhere. Now, the only way we can manipulate a process is with a file descriptor for the process. You want someone else to do it, we have to send them a copy of that file descriptor using some special API. So you can see this is practical to program with, but you'd have to change a lot of things to make this useful for many programs you've typically written, the biggest thing being how do we limit the files you can access useful. But there have been real OSs based on this capability design. And a common solution you might see is they might have like some server which gives out file descriptors, and it can enforce interesting policies like access control lists. So that's how you can build access control lists on top of this. It's like you have like a little program you talk to and say, I want this file, and that program says, oh, I know who you are, here, have a file descriptor for it or not. Okay. So another reason why these capabilities have been attractive is that there's an alternate implementation for capabilities, which looks very different from a high level. So capabilities we talked about, we just have a list in every process. Here are the things you can access, like the list of file descriptors. And each process, like number 5, means something different because it's an entry in that table. So an alternate idea is we have tokens, but they're the same number in every process. So if you want to pass a token to another process, you just pass the number you have. But you might say, well, that's global names now. You just went back to file names or process IDs. But the trick we're going to use is we're going to make it so you can't guess any IDs. We're going to make the IDs really big and random. So like we're going to choose 128-bit random numbers for every single ID. So you can keep trying IDs, but you're not going to guess any with high probability. And this is a real OS design that people have proposed. It's just based on this idea. and has the elegance that you don't need any special mechanisms for sharing information. That, you know, processes can just pass around resources this way, and you don't have to worry about, like, enforcing the access control, like, basically at all. Okay. So questions on this? Okay. So this is where I'm going to finish up for security. So next time, we're going to talk about virtual machines for our last topic. And then we'll have exam review.